Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today is one of those conversations that I've really been looking forward to. We're really talking about large scale, probably redesign of our entire system, I think. And very, very welcome to the podcast, Indy Johar.
Delighted to be here and delighted to be part of this wonderful series of talks. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it too.
Awesome. I'm going to start us off like I always do by asking you the very light and simple question of who are you, Indy Johar?
Okay, my name's Indy Johar. I trained as an architect. I grew up in the UK, was born in the UK and grew up in the UK, lived a few years in Delhi, actually. But really, I suppose what I've been looking at and sort of is, and with many other people with me, is how do we democratize the capacity to make our places and the environments around us? And democratize not through the vote, but actually the kind of societal agency, build societal agency to be able to make our futures. And, you know, so I trained as an architect, was part of building Zero Zero, and then was part of building stuff like OpenDesk, open source furniture company, to part of like a really amazing bunch of people who were building the Impact Hub network, building WikiHouse, open source housing, helped set up a couple of social investment structures. So been part of a journey of building things that democratize it. In about 2015-16, came to the conclusion that the things that we were building were implied by underlying structures, i.e. theories of property, theories of finance, theories of how value flows, even theories of currency, and how we contract, and theories of public and private. And it really started to dawn on us that actually some of the underlying structures were replicating a kind of systematic failure in the world. And so about 2015-16, sort of took a step back and then Stark Matter Labs, and that's what we've been doing, is looking at the stuff underneath the visible stuff around us and looking at how we need to more fundamentally change those things. Because I would say climate change, for example, it's a symptom of a failure, not the failure itself. It's a symptom of a failure where we're externalizing things, and our economies are designed to externalize costs. And those externalities are now self-terminating us because they're so significant. And so the root issue is, how do we reimagine our relationship with the world? And that's really what we've been working on.
That's resonant. And I'm curious to kind of double click a little bit on when you say the underlying structures. I'm pretty sure I understand what you mean. And I also know that there are lots of different stories in different corners, some dark corners of the web, and I think also some less dark corners of the web, where it's easy to understand what those structures misunderstand, let's say. What do you mean by underlying structures? Can you give an example to ground it in some way?
Yeah. So I would argue that one of the predominant structure of our current worldview is built on the thesis of humans having dominion over the world, humans then actually building an object-subject relationship with the world, the separation of humans to the world itself, that then being, you know, sort of accelerated by births of perspective, Cartesian logics. These all separated the world out. Classification theory, which separated us, individuated us. That was the hyper-individuation structures that allowed us to create the permission space of systemic violence. And that systemic violence has constructed our world around us. I'm not, you know, judging in a sense that I'm saying that's been the root. Now, the problem is that root was maybe okay, maybe not, but it was, we were able to exist and civilization wasn't failing because relatively, humans had a relatively insignificant imprint on the world in terms of externalities generated by that worldview. And now the violence is so systemic since the 1970s, that violence is now self-terminating us as a civilization. And that is, whether it's in pollution or in air pollution, sound pollution, plastics, whatever you want to talk about. And then it's also all sorts of other effects of not just externalization, but the capture of spillover values and the centralized capture of spillover values and vast concentrations of power and wealth as well. So I would say that's the underlying structure, and that structure manifests through coding of capital, like the private limited company, like property, the theory of property in itself, through some of the theories of private contracts, languages like public and private. It manifests through all those things.
Yeah, that's the big stuff. And if
yeah, it's not conspiracy theory stuff. It's sort of like the kind of structural stuff.
Right. And if we think about sort of timelines and arcs, like this is the arc, like sort of dominion story, if you will, or that underlying pattern or dominance. When do you see that started? Like what is the type of time frame that you're working with in terms of when this structure or story emerged?
I think the structure and story emerged. You know, some aspects of the story have been around for thousands of years. Like, you know, some aspects of our theory of our relationship with the world has been around. But I would say this story really accelerated over the last sort of 400 years. Newtonian Enlightenment, all of these things. This was where the story manifested itself in both the kind of a new bureaucracy, our capacity for abstraction of our money models, our abstraction of wealth, abstraction of title deeds, the creation of new bureaucratic systems. So once you can create a title deed, you can separate economic interest from embedded interest. So there's a whole bunch of abstractions that happened in the kind of last 400 years, which were aided by new capabilities that actually exploded this into a fundamentally new way. And that, I think, was over the last 400 years. Now, the world views have maybe existed. I think the other thing that happened was where we massively democratized or distributed this capacity around the world. Let's not say democratized, we distributed this capacity around the world as well. And that also constructed a kind of vast decentralized externalization frameworks.
Mm. So how do you propose, or like, what is your the nature of the work that you're currently doing? How do you address this pickle, like Jonathan Rawson would say?
So I think what we're seeing is that this crisis is inviting edits to these dark deep matter structures. So we're seeing whether it's rivers being made self-sovereign, or whether we're seeing working with communities to have a new relationship with land, as we're doing, where land becomes self-sovereign. So what we're seeing is when you start to take an entangled worldview again, our theory of governance of things is reimagined. Because in an entangled worldview, your governance cannot be centralized or specific to one stakeholder. And what you need to create is a different theory of trust with disentanglement. And what becomes really critical is you have to govern through the thesis of the thing or the not in itself. And that sovereignty of things becomes really critical as an arc of working with entanglements and to create the trust between multiple stakeholders. So if everything creates multiple beneficiaries, multiple liabilities, and it operates through multiple capitals, which is what we would argue, everything operates through those landscapes, your theory of governance of things has to go from ownership, which is abstraction, to single point interest, to effectively new forms of self-sovereignty around the thing itself, or self-governance around the thing. And we're seeing these things emerge. So lead communities around the world, whether indigenous communities working in partnership with indigenous communities, or whether it's crisis like deproportization as a result of people re-entrenching back from flooding post environmental events. We're seeing people have to challenge these realities. And so we're working around lead communities around the world, but also lead crises, which are starting to transform. And this is, I'm just talking about theory of property and governance. And we're seeing this stuff start to matter in technology. So, you know, we're exploring a sort of new way of governing sensors, which is not through ownership models, but actually a different model of governing sensors. And we're seeing this manifest through pretty much everything around us. So that's how we're starting to see. We're working on a house which owns itself, all the way through to different sorts of objects and new forms of governance of these civic economies in radical format. So we're seeing increasing demand at the crossover lead societies and lead communities around this sort of conversations.
Mm. And so I'm hearing, like, I don't know if this is the exact right term, but it sounds like you're almost creating institutions that would embody some sort of object-oriented ontology, almost, that you would expand the concept of sovereignty to more than just the human, so to say. So it's also interactions
Absolutely. Yeah, and also I would challenge the thesis of the object as well, where the object becomes much more an emergent phenomena of the entanglement of flows.
Mm.
So rather than it being a definitive system, it's an emergent phenomenon. And I think at that moment in time, the kind of multi-beneficiary, multi-liability, multi-capital nature, like a tree, for example, a tree planted by communities is 90% likely to survive, whereas a tree planted by local authorities is 50% likely to survive. And that's because the kind of relationships of care and the currencies of care are really critical. So if you look at this, and a tree has benefits in terms of flooding, has benefits in terms of air quality, it has benefits in terms of health. So it has multi-beneficiary, multi-capital systems. And that, I think, is an emblem of a new way of looking at things themselves. So whether it's the end-of-life waste, end-of-life, how do you embody, make sure the carbon of a tree is sequestered for 100 years, which is what we need it to do. So how do you look at these things through those systematic flows? So yes, so expanding our theory of agency to more than humans, and then simultaneously actually challenging the thesis of what the object is as an emergent phenomenon. And that also applies to us as humans. I think we have to challenge our own theory of self as being not individuated, isolated systems.
Mm. And this comes into something that I've been struggling with quite a bit in terms of, which is sort of boundaries in general. Like, and I'm, you know, I've looked a little bit at sort of the information theory part of, like, how boundaries, like how these entanglements of flows are in some way forming, and then they appear as, like, there's some sort of, I don't know, density, I guess, into the information flows, which would then appear as objects or something like that. But I'm still struggling with, like, the way that I see the world in terms of objects and separate things, and then my experience of the world, which is much more in line with what you're currently describing. And I don't know if you could give me another perspective there. Help me out.
No, I think the way to look at it is probably the Heidelberg uncertainty principle. It's almost like a fused. I think boundary-orientated thinking is useful, but I think it's not boundaries, it's relationships that drive it, and the kind of dominance and the strength of those relationships and the feedback systems that define it. So I do think there is a kind of challenge, and I think this is where I think computational capabilities are going to be really critical. So I think the reason why we think through objects is because object allows for simplification of bureaucracy, classification models, registry frameworks are simplified and allows us to do analog systems in a very clean way. I think what happens is when we move towards computational bureaucracy, that opens up the capacity to reimagine our relationship with objects, which we, you know, in mythos terms, we had historically, right? In mythos terms, that's exactly how we saw objects. We didn't see them as objects. We saw them as knots of flows in history and various times in indigenous frameworks and sort of different sort of historical frameworks. So what we're now seeing is computational bureaucracy open up the capacity to be able to open that landscape up again, but open that up not like as a replication of the past, but as a new capability, which actually allows us to be able to look at that at a planetary scale, which has never happened before. So I think there's also just recognizing how this stuff will happen. And I think the construction of agency will be a synthetic machine-wrapped agency around things, which I think will be the emergent phenomena that we'll start to operate in.
Mm. And computational bureaucracy, that's a new term for me. Could you just say something about it?
So currently our bureaucratic frameworks are really still like extensions of analog models of how we organize, classify, and structure. And what we're seeing, I think, is the birth of whether it's actually smart contracts or smart permissioning systems or even contingent systems or contingent regulatory systems, is the emergence of a new capability of how institutions allocate, share resource in different ways, both dynamically, through learning frameworks as well. And that computational capacity means that we can create a new implied sort of set of protocols which manifest very differently in different conditions. So they can support vast plurality at the implied order level, at the world that we see, whilst actually creating protocols which are actually quite coherent at the kind of singularity level, if you want to call it bureaucratic, kind of at the point where they become singular. And that is a function of computational capacity. So I think it's really worth recognizing that our treasury functions were, you know, our centralized treasury, national treasuries, are a function of bureaucratic capabilities. So as you start to reimagine our bureaucratic capabilities, I think we start to change pretty much everything around us. So, for example, bills of exchange, the kind of industrial revolution was, you could argue, a function of bills of exchange as tools, because they created decentralized capability of building money. We can now start to build new forms of synthetic resource capable money, which has integrity to it in a way that could never be done before, because the computational capacity exists to be able to actually give provenance to those asset backed or resource backed monies in high integrity, which allows us to be able to construct decentralized models of verification of that production of capital. So that's just one example of how bureaucratic capability starts to change our fundamental worldview. And I think that's going to happen everywhere around us. So that's the kind of, that's why we call it the boring revolution, right? So it's a revolution of bureaucracy, which actually people are really underestimating. And that transforms our nature of things at a fundamental level.
Ah, that's interesting. I was listening to, but because, and then there's like the tension arising in me with regards to, like, I guess what I'm, now I'm just speaking off of intuition. I haven't thought much about this, but I'm, there's something around sort of the human cognition, like the Vervaekian sort of the relevance realization piece, or like the wisdom piece or something like that, which is that, I mean, it feels like the computational part is, there's something around the brute force of computation. I'm thinking about sort of the AI, like this whole discussion that we have around sort of sentience and all of that stuff. And then people are saying, you know, it looks and feels like a thing that's sentient. And so what's the difference? And how do we, or like conscious, or, and there are all these like arguments about those things. And then somebody was making, I think it was Zach Stein, that was making an argument that, well, I mean, even though you have something that looks and feels like it, the nature of which, like how it's actually becoming, reaching these how it manifests in this way is, it's tricky. Like it is not sort of the wisdom part, or like the, it's not a result of more computation. And so like, because it feels like, I think what my sense was that the computational part is, does it have something to do with, it feels like there's more separation just at a finer resolution. Like, I don't know. I think, are we actually changing this? I don't know.
So I think you're right. I think there's a quantum quality to this. So at a certain point, when you get fine enough grained, the very nature of the thing changes itself. So I think that's what I'm seeing, is that, so if you take a kind of pixelated view on the world and you say, we're doing agent-based models at the level of a pixel, and these agent-based models are actually interacting with other pixels to be able to create an emergent phenomena, there's an emergent phenomena that emerges, which is resultant, which actually changes the nature of the things themselves. So, but I also want to say that I think we have to be much more careful about, when I'm talking about computational capabilities, I think we also have to talk about new human machine loop structures. So I think one of the things that's really critical is that currently, you know, I would say, you know, the machine learning capabilities are what I would, are geared towards plausibility. Right. They're not geared towards accuracy, they're geared towards plausibility.
Right.
So the correlations are words that create very high plausibility of an answer. That isn't actually how we build knowledge, but that's fine. This is where meta systems can build meta knowledges in a way that are systemically plausible, and that is very powerful. However, now imagine if you were using machine learning capabilities, and this is something we're working on, not to answer questions, but ask questions. Flip the relationship, right? At that moment in time, you have an ennoblement feedback mechanism between machine-human capabilities that opens up actually a thesis of wisdom, where humans aren't extracting ounces of plausibility, but are in a didactic relationship with vast scale knowledge systems and actually the exploration of those things. So I also think there's a fundamental paradigm shift in the interface between machine-human systems that's absolutely critical to this journey. So that's why, for me, when we start to look at bureaucracy, which is, I think that bureaucracy can be an ennoblement theory as opposed to a control theory. So currently what we have is a control theory bureaucracy, which is because that's the most, but control is virtually impossible in a complex emergent world, which is why we're at the edge of control theory. Being able to centralize control theory can't regulate the world. So actually flipping this to a didactic model between human machine systems, and then flipping this to actually being around this pixel-oriented democracy, sort of computational capabilities, opens up new phenomena of capability. So I think there's a deep structural transformation in the human-machine relationship, but also the human relationship at the end of the story.
Oh, wow. I'm like, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of popped up in my head, and it's like, we're at the point right now where we got the answer 42, and then they started a new computer, you know, which is starting to figure out, like, what's the right question? Like, you know, the meaning of life thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fun.
And I think this is, I know this is a really dense conversation. We've just gone straight into it. But I think these things, in a way, are really important. The lines that we're drawing here are really important. Without computational bureaucracy and without ennoblement-oriented computational bureaucracy, you can't get to the worldview that we're talking about at the planetary scale. And you can't, and we can't do this. And this is the other part of the story, which I think is really in game theory terms. I don't think there's a pathway for some parts of the world to survive and other parts not to survive. Because, you know, people like Daniel and various other people have said, the distribution of weapons of mass destruction, basically, and, you know, it's not, I'm not talking nuclear, I'm talking various other effects, actually means that actually there is only really two forks, not spectrums, two forks. Mutually assured thriving or mutually assured destruction.
Mm.
So we have a mad or a mat world.
Yeah.
And I think we have a choice. And so what this means is that actually we're going to have to move towards mutually assured thriving, which means that we're going to have to look at this from a planetary phenomena sense. And that, I think, for me is kind of, so if you look at these capabilities that we've been discussing about operating in entanglements and post and reimagining our thesis of objects and computational bureaucracy, that opens up a whole future of a new planetary relationship, which I think challenges doctrines of how we've governed and associated and structured the world around us. And that's why I think this is a different type of phenomenon. I think, you know, people like James Lovelock have very eloquently said in places like the first third of Novocene that we're in a moment which is the emergence of a machine-human ecological civilization, which is at a planetary scale. And this civilization is becoming self-aware. Right, so the capabilities of senses, the capabilities is we're actually operating at a planetary self-conscious system. For the first time, the planet is able to quasi protect itself from a meteorite and other things. That capability is a new planetary capability, and I think we're starting to build planetary capabilities that have never existed before, and that's part of this response. And our failures are all planetary, right? They're all externalities at a planetary level. So this requires us to fundamentally deal with this game theory problem at a fundamental level.
I'm going to need to sit with that a little bit. That's like, this is very much at the edge of what I'm able to take in cognitively. Just to kind of reorient us, you said something, and I think we might keep driving in the same vector anyways, but you said something around in our pre-call and also now with regards to property and ownership. And I kind of wanted to explore that a little bit as well, because we're talking about a completely different way of thinking about a relationship to objects. But let's start maybe in the ownership part. Like, how do you...
So I think firstly, let's start with ownership as we perceive it now, I think is a relatively new phenomenon. Ownership historically was a stewardship relationship, it was a responsibility to the thing itself. And it was a two-way relationship. So for example, I think it's in Sweden, if you owned soil in Sweden, farmland, if you increased the density of the soil and you would actually lower your inheritance tax. Right? So it was all focused on stewardship, right? Now, whereas actually what we've now done is, you know, there is basically farmland is priced equivalent to housing or potential housing risk, housing. So we've undermined our theories of ownership into abstracted value rather than embodied value. So just, I'm going to unbundle this slowly. And then what we've started to do is, you know, so if you look at the spillover responsibilities, so for example, if you use XYZ fertilizers and they spill over into other territories, into the water system, so we've tried to use regulation to control that. We've tried to use regulation. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to regulate. It's very complex in terms of information systems, verification systems, policing models. It's a very difficult model. So what we've got is these complex systems trying to be controlled through ownership and then regulation. And we've seen the kind of ownership becoming extracted to economic issues, which incentivizes the maximization of financial returns and the destruction of other forms of capital in the system. And then actually what we've got is a regulatory system that isn't able to handle it. So now that's the kind of systemic. And if you then fractalize that and you sort of see that world over, you know, like I think the stats are that, you know, this shirt, £40 shirt, if you did genuine true cost analysis, is between £250 to £450, right? So if you then take that as a worldview, all of our things around us have been optimized for externalization. Now, and that's largely a function of, actually, I would argue, our theory of property and our theory of ownership of who's currently understood it. And it's to do with, actually, in a complex, entangled world, it's actually incredibly difficult to govern abstractly. So the more you abstract things out, actually, you put, go to single-point indicators, single-point value. This is where computational capacity comes in, right? Mm. So now imagine you can wrap multi-stakeholder optimization of a farm into something that looks from the perspective of the farm, where finance is a stakeholder, but it's not the only actor, right? So suddenly you start to actually go from ownership as a model to self-govern. The farm, the land becomes a self-sovereign entity to which other people have relationships, including the water, including the birds, including the soil density, including, these are all relationships. And that is a paradigm leap to deal with complexity. Mm. And that's a paradigm leap that's emergently possible as a result of our computational bureaucracy. So what we're seeing, and I think what we're at the beginning of, is heralding a new age of how we relate to the world as a result of it. And it's rooted in our theory of property in that sense.
Mm.
If that makes
sense. So it's like, okay, I might, let's see if I'm following. What I'm hearing you speak to is that the computational capacity is the tool by which we can start looking at, like, expanding our analysis, let's say, of what's going on, like what's unfolding. Like we can include a larger set of things in terms of, or of, well, objects down in your or emergent property of relationships into our analysis. So when we start counting these things, we have, we're going to be able to visualize or interact with much more relationships than what was previously possible because of our limited sort of cognitive capability, or like our own, yeah.
Exactly. And also like different currencies, right? So as well. So for example, a love letter to a tree, which is what was being sent to Melbourne, is a currency. It's a currency of care, right? So how do you then not only talk about different forms of capital? This is, you know, multi-beneficiary, multi-currency systems, we've known about them, we've understood them, but we haven't had the bureaucratic frameworks to operationalize them. This is what the boring revolution is the kind of bureaucratic capabilities to be able to operationalize fundamentally different worldviews, because we've got the kind of capabilities to do that. And that changes these things at a deep level.
But so, I think, yeah, I'm definitely on my edge here of like feeling it. It's interesting, and there's like, and one of the things that we've been doing from our perspective, which is very much bottom up, is that we've made a construction, like an institutional construction, sort of reimagining what the limited company is to try to put it in relationship to a lot of these things that you're talking about. But we haven't sort of done any of the computational stuff. We haven't done any of the fancy sort of large scale stuff. We've just done it like very small, a unit of the company and like, sure. let's start breaking this open. And what I'm finding now, because we're getting people interested in this and they're starting to ask questions to me and my business partner that I've been working with around these things. But what I'm finding is like, even at the level where we are operating, which is sort of really just about aligning your personal desires and wishes and needs to the economic incentives, and then putting the economics incentives in relationship to the larger purpose or like the question that you're actually trying to address. So like kind of I've been using the Grameen Bank example, like that evolution of from like, oh, we do this as a great business model for rich white people that contributed to be richer. And then eventually sort of figuring out that no, like actually the flows needs to go back into the thing that we're trying to support. Like it should be poverty alleviation. So you cannot extract anything from the system. It has to flow back into the system, and the value creation has to come flow back into the system and become sort of socially collectively available. So that's kind of the type of thinking that we've been doing. But it's so difficult for the people that I'm talking to realize what that actually means, what the consequence for them personally and privately is. It's like there's like I get it on the larger level, but then when it kind of scales down into the individual, it gets really tricky and filled with tension. Yeah.
Well, it does, but it's. I mean, so for example, we've also been doing the same journey, right? So for example, we changed pay structures, right? Our pay is not compensation for the work that you do. We're not doing a compensation model. We're doing effectively trying to do a sort of a personalized universal income to allow you to do the work that you want to do. Right? I'm not the best paid employee in DM, right? So it's designed to create a liberating structure. We're trying to move, you know, we don't have a CEO model. What we've got is a sort of chief learning systems model. So a learning orientated organization. So I think the architecture of organizations, and I think the key structure of an organization of the 21st century will be its capacity to compound learning. So if an organization can compound learning, it becomes scale free, right? I'm not interested in whether you're 5 people or 1,000 people. The question is, can you effectively compound learning? If you can't effectively compound learning, which is what most large corporations can't, they are siloed micro unit systems with low compounding of capabilities. Actually, the only efficiency is the efficacy of capital and the efficacy of market control. They have no internal compound capabilities. So whereas and those are all being sort of arbitraged in many formats as a result of technology. So what we've got is a new paradigm of the firm coming to being, which I think fundamentally becomes a different type of organization at a root and branch level, all the way from, like I say, employment contracts to, you know, even our relationships that we design with partners are increasingly sort of partnership contracts, because we realize that the work that we do is not a transaction product. It's a discovery product. So you have to co-discover it, and that requires a different way of understanding it and relating to it in a fundamentally different type of relationship. And that requires high levels of trust. It requires different forms of frameworks, but it also requires different forms of accountability. So I think, you know, this changes everything, like, you know, with the way we've got the organization, the way we focus on learning at a fundamental level is changing the phenomena of how we organize. So we're a multi, you know, there's 60 of us around the world. And what the point is that we're compounding, 60 of us in our team, but many others around us who we're collaborating with. So the compounding capability is a USB. So I think the firm by itself, and this is why we open document things, we open source things, because we're actually phenomenas. We're creating a phenomena of a knowledge movement and a kind of a positional movement, because that's how you drive change in different formats. And open source, you know, many people say open source, oh, you lose your intellectual property. I don't think you do. I think what you do with open source is you build first mover advantage, and you also build your own competition to make you better. So your own competition to make you better, which actually drives actually next generation capabilities. You don't try to rent seek intellectual property. You're constantly evolving it, and you have to evolve it. And it's constant evolution. And that's a capability. That's a different type of capability. So I do think the kind of nature of the firm is fundamentally being questioned. I think we're going to see some of these things root and branch themselves. So I can see it all the way through.
And, okay. But, and so, let's talk about sort of Let's talk about pathways for getting there. And then on the very simplistic level, I'm seeing like two different things. One is like, oh, we have to do this so that we can start shifting, like moving towards there. There's like a step-by-step sort of model. It's like, oh, we do this first and then we do, or is it like, cause you're saying like open source it. And then I'm thinking, but isn't that risky or tricky in the current sort of paradigm? Because others might grasp, like actually try to grasp and limit and like box it in and extract from it. Or like, how do we, is there a, you just do the right thing and go and stay with the right thing? Or is it a, is this like an unfolding thing that like an act, sense, respond loop, which is?
Exactly. And I think it's not even just inside DM, right? We're part of an ecosystem that's evolving, and recognizing you're part of an ecosystem is really important. It's, you know, DM stands on the shoulders of many, many other brilliant people and with them. Yeah. And we're part of a loop. And I think ensuring that loop is where the real value is,
right?
Not DM, but actually the loop in the system. And that I think is, and I think from my perspective, increasingly, you know, the kind of, if you look at ChatGPT or any, the rate of adoption globally, I think our problem isn't going to be sort of adoption. Our problem is going to be discovery. As soon as it's discovered, the rate of adoption will be significant. But I think all we've got to do is actually build the kind of open, build the intervention, proofs of possibilities, build the communities of iterating that in different contexts. Things will change.
Right.
And, you know, fundamentally, like I said, we only have one pathway, mutually assured thriving. And life, I think, wants to live, as was brilliantly said somewhere in Jurassic Park. And I think that's what we need to do.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so I've just come out, I've spent some 50 hours with Thomas Piketty. I read the Capital and Ideology thing. And then, I mean, he's talking a lot about redistribution and kind of invoking the possibility or like challenging us to think that this is not the way that it has always been. And these are the ways that, and you know, you saw the same thing from a completely different lens with like Graeber and Wengrow and like their Dawn of Everything thing. It's like, oh, the cultural, like it hasn't always been like this. We don't have to dominate and we don't have to do it in this particular way. And but yet when it comes to solutions in both of those books, I think it starts feeling a bit flat, and yet what I'm intuiting from you, what I'm hearing from you, is like it's this vehicle of like it's the actual spinning of the wheel, which is the focus. Like, how do we make it spin so that it can self unfold or whatever? Yeah, I don't know what the
absolutely no exactly. And I think you're going to see fundamentals like property, fundamentals like contract, fundamentals like our theories of governance, fundamentals like monetary production. These are all going to evolve. And whilst I mean I recognize Thomas Piketty's sort of analysis of the system, right, which is actually the concentration of wealth, right? I don't believe redistribution is the story. And the reason why I say that, or not direct redistribution, and I think the reason for that is that if you play a net zero sum game, which is that if you have something and I have something, the only way forward is for me to take stuff off you, we create the frameworks of systemic violence, right? And you know, and not that I'm shying away from that, but I think there are pathways like quantitative easing. There are pathways which are nonlinear redistribution mechanisms, non-direct, which are really critical. I think the kind of decentralization of monetary production, actually, that will change the concentration of wealth structures. So I think we have to look at the deep codes. I think our theories of sort of new reimagining what assets are. So, for example, what is the care or the collective intelligence of a city? Reimagining our asset codes will change the theories of value. So I get exactly where he's going. I just think the pathway to get to where he wants to go isn't direct confrontational, because I don't think we can afford the systemic war that we're going to open up in that landscape. But I think we can get to the same result, if not faster, but also shift theories of value much more structurally. And I think that's where we have to go.
That's great, because I mean that's also what I'm hearing you speak to when you talk about the multi-currencies, sort of multi-capitals, and like that's a completely different way of understanding those words than what we currently think about capital and currencies in terms of, if I'm getting it right.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Is there I'm so curious, but is there like a particular, is there like a project or something that you're allowed to talk about that you're currently engaged in that we could, like, if you would kind of give us a peek under the blanket in some way of like what DM is doing and like how does it come to be, like if we ground it like very sort of tangibly in some example.
Okay, so let's imagine a house. So let's imagine the house, the land on which the house sits, is multi-stakeholder, right? It's multi-stakeholder in terms of the water, the bees, the butterflies, the soil, the ecological landscape. So the land is self-sovereign. So, and its purpose is to enhance the liveness of land. The house in itself is a knot of materials. Those materials, let's say, are from, and those materials, you don't want to own them because what you want to do is for those materials to be custodian relationships. I am a custodian of those materials, but they're actually in a chain of value which allows them to be circularly held. That means those materials are part of a new thesis, which is not necessarily about ownership, but custodianship, and a chain of custodian, not customers, custodianship. So the person that milled the timber is just a custodian of the timber, and they're just chains of custodianship, which actually share. Now reimagine that as a new material registry, a new way of financing that, a new way of having depreciation accounting on that. That starts to change the materiality of that. Then imagine the environment itself, light pollution, air pollution, sound pollution, which are actually all the microviolences of those environments. Imagine those are the actually microbiome capacities. Those are then effectively the standards, or they're the social costs that are understood actually to be able to reimagine the house and the quality of the house to make sure it's human generative, but also actually ecologically generative. Now, then let's imagine use rights on that house, where I have the rights to use that house and I have the obligation to use that house. If I'm not using the materiality, there is a social opportunity cost to society. So what does that use rights look like? So if you look at those bundle of relationships, and then also let's imagine that that house, so that house, for example, is, if I took your house, my house, put it in the middle of Nova Scotia, how much is the house worth? Nothing. The house's relationship is with its civic goods. So now let's imagine the house is a net beneficiary to pay for. So a house in a catchment area of a good school in the UK has nearly £70,000 to £100,000 worth of additional value. So, or tree lined street or a park or civic goods. So now let's imagine the house is a generative house, which is then sharing the value with these social goods. So if you look at those flows of value and you start to structure them, you start to actually reimagine the relationship, everything around that house and how it manifests. So that to us is something we're building called the free house. And we're constructing the components of that as a system demonstrator. So we physically want to demonstrate the house, but also do the system level contracts. Now imagine how you finance that house. Do you finance it in the same way? Does it print its own money? How does it finance? So you start to think about its financing arrangements in different ways. So that whole stack as a system demonstrator is one of the things that we're building. And, you know, we're building multiples from, you know, sort of a free forest, free house, a new type of self-owning surveillance camera, to we're building a whole suite or looking at rivers and how they can be governed in that way. So that's just one example of those things. And that changes all sorts of things like interfaces with these contracts. So how do you interface with these contracts, and how are these contracts held? How do you hold these contracts without creating, you know, what is the right relationship of privacy and accountability in those frameworks? How do you construct them in different formats? So all of these things. Then imagine the house is a generative house. It's got energy being produced, water being produced, air quality being improved, microbiome being generated. So this is a generative system in itself. So that stack is an example of one of the things that we're building.
Ah, that's fascinating. And I'm like, at the same time, I'm wondering, like, when I would go to my wife and say, you know, let's not do the ownership thing with our house that we have here, you know, which is sort of, you know, it's very fundamental for our sense of safety and like all of that stuff. I mean, it provides for us, right? And let's shift to this other thing. I mean, I would have a very hard time. I mean, and it would come down to the trust components. Like, what do you mean not own? Like, that's the nature by which, you know, and then.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've been addicted to theories of ownership by multiple means, right? So one is trust. So second is effectively also you know, more people earn more money out of their homes than they do out of work. So actually, we've created an economic incentive, which is so systemic in that story. This is why we don't think these futures are going to be built like in London or in, I don't know, Reykjavik, where there's the housing shortage. They're going to be built in places that are at the edges of the world, that these new paradigms are necessary to be able to transform. And then they will import across. And so that's why I talk back to lead communities and lead societies. Where is this future going to be built? It's not going to be built in the likes of London, New York yet. It's going to be built in different frameworks. So, and I think that's why also finding where the lead societies are for these conversations is really critical. But the paradigm is really critical because that's the only way we deal with the externalities. So if you did a true cost analysis of your house, it's extraordinary. If you talk about systemic affordability, I don't think people can afford a house in terms of system. So our thesis at a deep root level is being challenged. And I think that challenge is not a choice. It's a forced reality that's coming at us. So I think the hard question is, will we be able to traditionally own homes in the future? And then, and I don't mean, and I really am not a lot, I'm not saying ownership to rental. I'm really not saying that. I'm really not. I don't want new rent-seeking systems. So that's why this paradigm of self-ownership actually starts to create a new frame of trusted frameworks, which goes out beyond the theories of rental in the historic formats.
I wanted to like double-click on because you said true cost, and I think you mentioned it before as well. And it kind of skipped to the whole how the energy crisis is unfolding at the moment, let's say in Sweden, for instance, where the economic cost of energy, which is far from sort of the true cost of energy. I mean, the surge in prices just due to the economic logic, and then how that could have been, let's say, an encouragement. I mean, it is in a way, people have reduced their energy consumption and so forth, but still there is this logic then where the current sort of bureaucratic system goes in and subsidizes this type of, because of the logics of the system itself. And then, do you see vectors or pathways towards like a true cost world, or like where is that bubbling? Like how?
I think true cost is coming at us. So I would argue that the geopolitical situations we're seeing are also part of the repricing of certain value and risk into the world. So I think we're starting. Food prices have gone up 40% in the UK alone, right? So I think, you know, carbon pricing, all these things, which are nominal right now, nowhere near true cost in terms of they. So we're starting to see these things either directly or unpriced risks, right, start to manifest into the system. So I think for me, you know, anyone that, you know, I think unpriced risks are much more substantial than price risks right now. And anyone who's looking at a future portfolio should be looking at their unpriced risks because currently the market isn't valuing them. It doesn't mean that they aren't valuable. And they have real liabilities on the other side of them in terms of asset destruction. So I think we're starting to see those things come to the table. I also think, you know, discounting energy markets maybe was the right thing because actually the consumer capacity to be able to absorb that wasn't there because we hadn't built the transitioning infrastructure. So I also think governments are going to have to step in those frameworks. At the same time, they're going to have to step in to be able to transfer us to different economies around this stuff. So I think we are going to see structured transitions of our markets and our production systems at radical levels. And I think, you know, I would be encouraging governments to actually take structural industrial transition plans, which are sector by sector, looking at what those transitions, and not even sector by sector, because it's not going to be, you know, I don't think we go from, you know, motor vehicles sort of driven by petrol engines to electric vehicles. I think we go from, you know, petrol engines to electric bikes. So it's not even a linear sector by sector response. It's a systemic outcome-based response. So we're going to have to look at key industrial transition. And, you know, if you were to, I think the stats were 68% of S&P 100s were priced social and environmental costs, most of them wouldn't be viable. So if that's the case, then we have to start to talk about the systemic transition of our industrial frameworks at root and branch level, which I think is what we're facing. So it's a bit more like World War II rebuilding than anything else.
And am I hearing you right that you still have faith that we will be able to do this through the current institutions, so to say? Or is it more like the parallel polis type thing where something else will be built in like sort of an adjacent?
My thesis on this is more that I think life will find a way. I'm optimistic in that sense. Life needs a way. I think there is no pathway without mutually assured thriving. So that means all of us might find a way. So that's second. Third, I think our dissemination and our kind of adoption capabilities, we've built them, that we can adopt new technology and capabilities at speed. And third, the context that's demanding it, we are going to be moving through a combination of crisis response, and we're going to be moving through a conversation, sort of what I said, lead societies. Those two things are going to push and pull, and they're going to push and pull what I would call the edge of the system, and that's fine. And that's how change happens. The middle largely adopts. The edges are actually where the system transforms. But when it transforms, its ability to replicate to the system is pretty significant. So I'm hopeful.
Mm. I thought I had like a bunch of other questions, and at the same time, it feels like that's a really nice place to end on. But rather, I'd like to ask it this way, perhaps. Like, due to my sort of, I mean, now I've been asking us questions into this whole thing, and like based on sort of, and I've really been, you know, at the edge of my capacity for like understanding some of these things and so forth. So I'm feeling. Is there something obvious or is there something not obvious but important that I've missed that I should have, like, you know, is there something else here that needs to kind of support the arguments that we're doing that needs to be explicit?
So I think the one final thing I'd say is that at the root of this is also reimagining what it means to be human. And, you know, I think our thesis of being human has been individuated and has been understood through our physical body, like Vitruvian Man, and, you know, sitting there platonically, and has undermined actually the microbiomes around us, the social brain that works around us, undermined our genetic, epigenetic relationships, undermined all sorts of our language structures that are actually social structures of seeing. So actually, and undermined even theories of identity, we think we have an A identity when actually we're a spectrum of identities. Our pronouns, we talk about singular pronouns, but we should perhaps all be we, they, them, right? We should actually embrace the multitude that we are. So I think there's a sort of, there's a deeper transformation of ourselves that's actually at the root of this as well. So it's not just about relationship to the world. These revolutions, in my view, have always been reciprocated in a transformation of what it means to be human, and thereby actually a relationship with the world. So I think, you know, one thing we, you know, I wanted to just nail down here was I think there is a transformation of what it means to be human, and that's a deep code transformation of how we recognize ourselves and our relationship to the world and our relationship of violence, you know, microviolences and other things. And it is a kind of new human development framework that's absolutely critical. So as kind of the Industrial Revolution put us in schools and taught us how to be bad machines or bad robots, you know, so go in at 9, finish at 3, it was kind of coding us to be bad machines. I think there is a new requirement for a new developmental framework that opens us up to actually unshackling us as bad machines, to re-embrace a new human capacity at a different level. And that's a reconceptualization of what it means to be human. So this revolution is not just an external facing one, it's an inner development one. And sort of there I reference obviously the inner development goals and the work that's going on with people like Thomas Bjorkman and his team as well around this. So there's a kind of two-way conversation on this.
And that's interesting that you say that, because I think what I'm... Because now, I mean, I'm talking through a lot of people that are really ambitious about this change, this transformation or transition, or like this thing that we have looming in front of us, and that are worried about the state of the world, and that are applying themselves to do something, so to say. And at the same time, I'm feeling like there are so many sub-optimizations that I see in these different efforts, that there are some sort of beliefs that are held onto very strongly around, with depending on sort of which doorway you entered into this space with. And speaking to you, I'm getting like, I get to fall forward in a way and like really sort of open up into something of like even more doorways than I haven't. You're bringing in so many different lenses into this. It's so sort of transdisciplinary. You know, so in a way, it's like, it's even, because otherwise I'm that guy that keeps bringing in different sort of lenses in these conversations. And I'm just thinking about that, you know, is it a lean or agile thing, which is like, if you have a sub-optimization, then you know.
No, But I think you've nailed it, right? I think one of the big things about this revolution, it's polymathic. It's a polymathic revolution. It's not a disciplinary revolution. And, you know, every revolution probably is a polymathic revolution. So Newton, all these people were polymaths in themselves, and they created the kind of pathways and the silos for other people. And I think this is a polymathic revolution. And I think, you know, one of the kind of things that, you know, sort of people like even Peter Thiel talk about is how we've undermined the polymathic capacity of society. Systematically we've undermined it. So one of the key weaknesses that we have is our polymathic capacities at the transdisciplinary capacity. And it's not just, I think one of the things is it's embodied craft experience at the polymathic capabilities. It's not just knowledge. It's how you have embodied craft experience. Because too often I sort of hear, you know, people say, oh, we can draw a system diagram. And it's like, yeah, you can draw a system diagram, but actually to have experienced some of this stuff and experience the relationship is actually a different thing. So the question, I think one of the big challenges that we have, and I think you're right, is building that polymathic craft capabilities. And that's been one of my biggest things, like, you know, building DM, you know, we've got finance people, we've got sort of lawyers, we've got sort of anthropologists, we've got urban designers, we've got sort of architects, we've got ecologists, because actually the polymathic capacity of the institution is really critical to be able to actually build, and that's where your systemic investment is building shared comprehensions and languages, and that's why the learning rotation is fundamental. So I would argue that what you've said there is a polymathic capacity of institutions is really critical, and what we've got is very monolithic, monostructured institutional capabilities, which are actually undermining our capacity to see the world and the richness and multiplicity of doors that we're seeing. So I spot on agree.
I love what you're saying with regards to the embodied as well, because I think, I mean, I love skiing and I love climbing and I love, like, I'm starting to get into like Brazilian jiu-jitsu and wrestling, and like what I'm finding there, and like when I need to shift people or things, like when I need to like move myself down the mountain, for instance, I mean, it doesn't feel the way that it looks. Like if you looked at it and you hadn't done it and then you would describe it, I think you would describe something completely different from the capacities that you would need to actually do it.
But this is a really important point. That's like, I think we've undervalued, this is what I mean, like codified knowledge versus embodied knowledge. Embodied knowledge is vastly multidimensional, but codified knowledge is very thin. And it's very useful when you aggregate it at a planetary scale. Very useful. But it isn't embodied knowledge, and isn't that. So these are fundamentally different types of knowledge frameworks, which I think, and unfortunately, embodied knowledge, or fortunately, is a polymathic capability. And I think that is a real contribution of humanity, and operating at a multi-currency level. It's intuitive. It's all sorts of other forms of knowledge structures. And intuition is kind of semi-predictive landscape that we operate in, which is a unique capacity of humans to build, or not unique, but certainly very spectacular capacity of humans in that sense. So I think you're right. I think this kind of craft intuition, polymathic capabilities are really powerful knowledge structures. And that's a USP.
Yeah. And it seems like you could kind of develop an understanding for what it, or a humility by engaging in any craft, almost. Like if you really truly aim for mastery in one craft, you will at least be humble enough to say in your other, or there's a possibility that you were humble enough or cultivate that capacity for humility in the other aspects to say, I don't know. Like I haven't done this yet. Like, yeah.
More than that, I think if you become a supreme craftsperson at something, I think you can see the underlying structures of the whole world. It's that kind of paradigm of, you know, you can see the whole world through a grain of sand. And I think actually the entanglements of things leads you to be able to understand things in a deeper way. So I think deep craft touches everything.
Wonderful. Yeah. Let's just stop here. And thank you so much, Indy, for, and if people want to interact with you or the work that you do or find out more, where should they go?
Just drop us a line at Dark Matter Labs. Be always happy to kind of interact and engage and help as we can. And thank you for this podcast. I mean, I like doing these things. I know it was super dense, and I apologize to the listeners in advance because I kind of went through a lot of stuff very quickly. But what I'm trying to do is not just show one piece of thought, but the line of thought that's required. And in a way, it's the underlying line of thought that's important rather than a thought. And if you can get that sense, I think that's what's game-changing rather than individual thoughts in that. So that's partly why I apologize for my denseness.
I enjoyed it. It certainly moves me in good ways. So thank you. Thank you so much.